Hello and welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name is Peter Frey. I'm the co-director of the Centre for Media Transition at University of Technology Sydney, and my producer today is the esteemed professional Anthony Dockrell. Today, I am delighted to welcome to the program Bill Birnbauer, a multi-award-winning investigative journalist, a recipient of the prestigious J.S. Knight Fellowship at Stanford, a journalism academic from Monash in Melbourne and other places, and now, and most importantly, an author of a great new book on not-for-profit investigative journalism. That's not-for-profit work in the United States, but as we will all appreciate, and as we're about to hear, the lessons from Bill's book are very much applicable to Australia, especially given the recent announcement of the $100 million Judith Nielsen Institute for Journalism Ideas, plus a string of federal government-level attempts to do more to support public interest journalism, and a very interesting debate, and a very urgent and interesting ongoing debate about public interest journalism in this country. Bill, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm very well and very happy to be here, Peter.
Well, it's great to have you, and congratulations on the book, which weirdly, I understand, is the first in the world on the subject. So how did Bill Birnbauer, humble Australian investigative journalist, get to write this world first book? Tell us the background of that.
Well, it's a long background. I was lucky to receive a Knight Fellowship at Stanford, as you mentioned, and that really introduced me to the whole idea of foundation-funded both journalism and journalism education. And then in the late 90s, I received a letter out of the blue. At that time, I was a reporter at The Age, and I can't remember what beat I was doing, but having been at Stanford, the ICIJ, which is the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, was setting up from Washington. And what it did was cherry-pick various reporters from Stanford, who might have had a bit of an investigative inclination, as well as Harvard, and invited them to join this outfit, a new outfit, a non-profit outfit that would do global investigative journalism. Mm-hmm. And I remember receiving this letter, and I thought, what the hell is this about? Because it had language such as, you are one of the world's leading investigative reporters. And I thought, yeah, okay.
Well, that was true. It's not, they weren't lying.
What is this about? And we're inviting you to join other reporters in as many countries as possible to work on stories that are global in nature. That is, stories that don't stop at a border. So we're looking at corruption, environmental issues, and so forth. And we're going to do this in a collaborative way. Mm-hmm. Now, you might remember I was a fairly competitive journalist in my day, and I thought the whole notion of actually collaborating with an American journalist or someone in Brazil or possibly in Africa or Europe seemed a bit foreign to me. So I was kind of intrigued, but a bit wary. Mm-hmm. What happened then was they decided they'd invite us all to a conference. And I think the first one was, it was either in Washington or up in Boston. Mm-hmm. And we got together, and there were about 60 of us there, and investigative journalists from, 40 or 50 countries. And I realized then that we all had basically the same values, the same interests, the same methodologies. I thought this could be okay. The leaders of the ICIJ were very impressive people, people like Chuck Lewis and Maud Bielman at that time. And I got involved in doing a couple of projects for the ICIJ. Just quickly, one was about how tobacco companies were forming alliances with criminal organizations. And the second one was about water privatization around the world. And what we produced, actually, I thought was quite incredible, because here I was at The Age doing what I think is reasonable journalism. I don't like to comment on my own work. But what I was really excited about was writing about tobacco smuggling into China. And mm-hmm. that sort of inflamed me, and I could see the potential of a collaborative network and also non-profit journalism. So that was really the beginning that opened my eyes to that whole non-profit.
What year was that, roughly?
That was in the early 2000s.
Right. Okay, so it really has been a long labour of love, this book.
Well, it has indeed. And so when I took a buyout from Fairfax, now Nine, back in 2008, I became a tenured senior lecturer at Monash, and I was teaching investigative journalism and feature writing. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I undertook a PhD, and I figured, well, let's have a look at this model. And initially, I was going to look at what are the lessons for Australia from the non-profit sector. But look, it grew so rapidly during the GFC years, and I'm talking about the global financial crisis in 2008, 2009, and part of 2010. And what happened there was fascinating, because there was an explosion in the number of non-profit organisations starting up and foundations pouring money into that sector. And so I figured, well, let's do some research. And when I looked around, there wasn't much to be read. So I thought, oh, well, maybe I'll give it a go and do it myself.
Yeah, well, and it's a very interesting picture, because the picture you present is quite sobering. You don't pull any punches. It's certainly not a book you read and go, oh, rah-rah journalism. I mean, it's very vitally important what you've written about journalism, but it's not, oh, isn't journalism great? You're very sober about it. And parts of it is very painful, because you do paint this picture in the broad, and you know, there's a lot of detail in here, and I'd encourage any listener interested in this to go and get the book. But in the broad, you paint this picture of the not-for-profit sector in the US being sort of dominated by donors to, you know, a few, if you like, rock star outfits, and then a lot of other not-for-profits really doing it hard. I mean, there's this massive funding disparity, right? Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, absolutely. Look, what I didn't want to do was romanticize it. And what I tried to, even though I am inflamed, I have to tell you, with the work that some of these nonprofits are doing, I'm very excited about the journalism, some of which is winning Pulitzer Prizes. I mean, it is the leading edge of investigative work and data journalism mm-hmm. in the United States. However, I didn't want to come at this with sort of rose-coloured glasses. And, you know, the disparities you mentioned are enormous. So we've got three or four non-profit organisations, and I'm talking about ProPublica, the Centre for Public Integrity, the Centre for Investigative Reporting, and Mother Jones, which are all very different, but, you know, they're national in scope, really sucking up a lot of the foundation and other funding in the sector. At the same time, you know, I visited some of the smaller outfits, and I walked into an office and there's a desk and a chair and a computer and an old crusty guy sitting behind it. And I said, you know, is this the office of this non-profit that's producing all this brilliant work? And the guy says, yeah, that's me.
Right.
So, you know, we're looking at budget differentials in the tens of millions of dollars annually for the bigger nonprofits. And for the smaller ones, you know, somewhere between $100,000 and $200,000 mm-hmm. and a significant difference in the amount of work being produced and the quality of work as well.
So why does this happen? Is it basically donors being a bit bedazzled by, you know, a few, as I say, rock star outfits and the rest not quite hitting the buttons? Because one of the other things you point out is that more often than not, the ones that are missing out on the funding are trying to address these issues, which in the US is called these news deserts, you know, and a lot of local reporting or state-based reporting or health and environment stuff reporting on minorities. They're the ones who are missing out. And you obviously argue that there is as vital to the sort of journalism ecosystem as the big picture investigative pieces, right?
Yeah, the real news deserts in the United States and probably here as well are in regional areas and in cities. So just to give you an idea of these disparities before I come to the reasons. So the Institute for Nonprofit News is like an association of nonprofit organizations in the United States. And I look at the funding of about 60 of these organizations between the years of 2009 and 2015. And I found they were funded to the tune of about $470 million, which, you know, is a fair chunk of money, really, for the nonprofit sector. Nothing like the amount of funding generated in the mainstream media. Nevertheless, a significant amount of money. But those organizations that I mentioned, all three of them, ProPublica, Center for Public Integrity, Center for Investigative Reporting, sucked up about 40% of that money. And when you look at the 470,000-odd, the top 20 nonprofits in the United States, of which there are around 200, took up about $430 million. The bottom 20, in my little survey, only received $7 million or 2% of the total. So there is this massive disparity of funding. And I think part of that reason is that the big foundations, and I'm talking about the Knight Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, the McCormick Foundation, the Ford Foundation, are really quite conservative in nature. And, you know, they're going to organizations and granting to organizations. They know the journalism, they know the people, and they know that when those organizations, the nonprofit organizations, publish a story, it's very likely that that story will also be published in media with a lot of capital. So I'm talking about the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune. So, you know, I think that partly explains the reasons. The other reason is that for some of these that are scattered around the United States, they're either niche organizations or trying to report on cities. Community foundations, family foundations, individuals are really yet to understand grasp the fact that journalism that's being produced by these organizations is a public good. So, you know, they're giving to the opera and they're giving to other charities, and but they're not giving to journalism. So unless that increases that awareness within regional and local foundations, which the picture over there is totally different to Australia. There are many more foundations. You know, this grassroots news desert will continue to grow, unfortunately.
Well, of course, the situation is in this, on terms of philanthropy, is even more bleak here. But I'm going to pose a hypothetical for you. Okay, so a woman who supports the arts usually and various other things suddenly calls you up and says, "Bill, I've read your book. I love everything you've done on you know, as a journalist. You're a fantastic academic. And now I can see you've got some great expertise in supporting journalism, philanthropy, etc. My name is Judith Nielsen. I have $100 million. Bill, what do you do with it?"
Okay, so, you know, what I would like to do with it is supplement what the mainstream media is doing. I want to set up an organization that does public interest and investigative journalism. To do the kind of stories that are not being done in Australia, and we could go through a whole list of those kind of stories. I would then employ 10 investigative journalists and then all the production people as well, and I would do long-term investigations, 6 months, a year, 2 years, all in the public interest. Mm-hmm. That those stories wouldn't just be published on whatever website we choose to set up, but they would also be offered to organizations, to Four Corners. Would they take it? I don't know. They can't really resist a great story. The Nine people, the Australian, the Murdochs, or whoever. so that we co-published at the same time. Mm-hmm. The fact is, the media here, and there are some fantastic individual investigative journalists, simply can't afford to take a year or 2 years to produce stories that some of these non-profits are producing.
Mm-hmm. So have you set this up, or are we talking hypothetical?
No, I haven't. I'm retired.
You'll never retire, my friend. But
that's true.
Have you put it to the Judith Nielsen Institute?
No, I haven't.
And why not?
They haven't. I'm waiting for them to talk to me because, in your introduction, you described my background. Surely they would know it. I haven't contacted them. I'm happy to talk to them. I did speak to the ACCC this morning, and they're looking at this whole area as well as part of their digital inquiry. I've also put in submissions to the Senate, which have been adopted. And here's $100 million. If they're wondering what to do with it, I could certainly give them a few hints. What I hope they don't do is spend it on further, stuff like further research, setting up anything that's kind of journalism related. I would like to see that money going to the production of public service journalism.
As opposed to thinking and talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. And have you had anything to do with the Public Interest Journalism Initiative that comes out of Melbourne?
I've consulted with them. I'm not on the board, but I have spoken to them extensively. And again, I spoke to them this morning briefly. And they're quoting me left, right, and centre. So,
well, I've noticed that. Yes,
I'm just doing it as the benefit of my research, really.
Mm. Oh, Bill, it sounds like I should become your agent.
Maybe. Look, I'm a journalist at heart, and, probably 90% of journalists, 10% an academic. And, journalists, one of the challenges journalists in the US have faced in setting up these organizations is that they know journalism and investigative journalism and how to pursue a story, but they don't know about marketing and they don't know about paying the rent and paying salaries and selling stories and so forth. Yeah. So it's or fundraising, I guess, is the big one.
Yeah.
So that there's only so much time.
Well, we should talk when we're off air about all this, but tell me, do you see any signs of hope in the local sort of sector? I mean, for instance, the Balnaves and the Susan McKinnon Foundation have recently, last year or so, given quite a bit of money to the Guardian, the local Guardian. And there is things like the PIG, the Public Interest Journalism Initiative, and obviously quite a lot of attention at a government and quasi-government level, Senate Inquiry, ACCC, etc. So do you detect that the sort of, if you like, the atmospherics are changing?
Yes, I do. And I found the last 10 years looking at this incredibly frustrating because of the lack of activity here in Australia. But no, there are stirrings, which is a very positive sign. There's quite a way to go as yet. And I think into that mix, obviously, should be universities, I think, which do have a lot to offer in terms of all the facilities and students and people who can do research and so forth. University-based centres are quite popular in the United States. So there are stirrings. What isn't particularly, apart from Judith Nielsen and maybe Susan McKinnon, I don't think foundations or philanthropic organisations in Australia are yet seeing journalism as an area of need. How they need to view journalism is like people see the opera, art galleries, education, a public good, an institution that needs support. And that includes both the wealthy funders but also the mum and dad donors. So there needs to be a recontextualization and an increase in media literacy about what journalism can achieve, what is its role in a democracy, what is fake news and spin, and what is real journalism. Mm. So I think there's a really broad education program campaign at all levels, really, that needs to take place. And for, some philanthropists to think, well, you know, I've given to a cancer ward, why don't I give to, Michael West, for example, or
Bill
Matilda or someone like that.
Yeah.
There's not that recognition as yet.
But do you think journalism, in a sense, has failed to make that case? Because it was supported for so many years by a different business model, essentially an advertising-based business model, and it didn't have to be having that dialogue with its readers necessarily. Some of us did, some of us didn't, but it didn't necessarily have to have that dialogue. And so, therefore, you know, decades have gone by, and people have taken it for granted. And now, when the golden goose is gone, we have to change what we say about ourselves.
I think I might be, speaking generally from my experiences, very rarely thought about the audience. Mm. There was this notion of A list, A readers and B readers and so forth, but we didn't do enough really to pass on why we think what we do is important. And I think journalists were fairly arrogant. I think they believed they should set the news agenda, that the public were recipients rather than contributors to the news, and that, we'll tell the public what's important. Now, that's obviously changed to a degree, maybe not enough. But I think what we're seeing now and what you're describing really is the product of that kind of arrogance.
Mm. We've woken up, but hopefully we haven't woken up too late. Tell me, are there, putting aside foundations and donation, rich people, what other business models do you see that could possibly fund investigative journalism?
Well, look, I really like the Mother Jones kind of model that's been built up over the last 40 years. And, they're funded largely not by foundations or wealthy people as such, but by readers. And I really like that model, the subscription kind of model. Yes, they've got a magazine that comes out every couple of months, I think, but mainly their website. They're constantly appealing for funds. So, I think unless you can actually grasp that kind of support, you're not really proving your relevance to the readership. So I think that model really is important and crucial. And there are endowments, the endowments kind of model. I think in the US there are also kind of commercial setups, maybe Lencest might be one in Philadelphia, which then put their profits into the nonprofit sector. But it is limited. There are only so many sources of money. Unfortunately, in the States, there was when I first started looking at this, everyone thought foundations would fund these endeavors for three or four years, and then we'd all get earned revenue and we wouldn't depend on foundations. Well, that hasn't happened. Earned revenue, what we're talking about there are story sales. Well, the mainstream media don't pay for stories over there from nonprofits. We're looking at events management, like the Texas Tribune runs events virtually every day. Mm. We're talking about classes, summer schools, and so forth. Very little. It's really does depend a lot on foundations.
We had Robert Rosenthal on the show middle of last year from the Center for Investigative Reporting, and one of the things he said, which I thought was very interesting, was the other area they explore is different forms of investigative journalism. So, traditionally, investigative journalism, a big, big newspaper piece, if you like, or a big website piece, or a big TV piece. It's long. It's got a lot of deep research in it. But he was, for instance, talking about investigative journalism that can be iterated as a cartoon book, a comic book, a movie, a play, all sorts of things. I mean, that area is largely untapped in this country, right? I mean, there's not a lot of examples of it.
Yeah, Robert's been a leader in that field. So, you know, when they did a big investigation on schools that are located in earthquake-prone areas, they produced a comic book for kids, basically, to teach them safety. They produced an app where you could actually locate the earthquake faults.
Wow.
They also had finger puppets. They had poets taking the outcomes of investigations. They had street theatre type things. So, you know, Robert Rosenthal, probably more than anyone that I came across, hunts audiences, produces Spanish versions, you know, foreign language versions of all these stories. Now, you know, Reveal, they've rebranded into Reveal,
yes.
Is run on public radio with, I think, about 500 stations across the United States. And so more than anyone, he has actually chased audiences. And so when the other thing they did was when they produced an investigative story, they would distribute it to newspapers, and they would look at each story, look at the locality of the newspaper, and make it specific to that region. So, you know, put a different intro on it, put a different emphasis on it, quote some locals. They did all that work in order to increase their reach.
Mm. So if you were talking to your younger self, so the 20, how old were you when you joined? You joined the Melbourne Herald first, didn't you?
I did, back in 1975.
Okay, let's go back to 1975, and the older, more mature, much more wiser Bill Birnbaum can talk to the younger Bill Birnbaum in 1975. What would the older one say to the younger one?
That's a pretty good question.
I had to come up with one.
I don't think I'd give myself any different advice. I'm one of those fortunate people that kind of fell into journalism, and it kind of happened, and I took to it, I think, more than I would take to anything else that I might try. Work hard. I think I worked, and you might remember this from the days back at the Sunday Age, but I worked incredibly hard, and for some reason that I'm yet to put my finger on, and I'm not that introspective, but I really did stories that involved seeking justice for people who are in some way done over by other individuals or the system. So I'm a bit of an equalizer in that sense. But no, my advice would be pretty much to pursue your passion, really.
And work hard.
And work hard, yeah.
Okay, yeah. All right. Yeah. You're listening to The Fourth Estate across Australia on the Community Radio Network, coming to you from 2SER Studios in Sydney. And my name is Peter Frey, and my guest is Bill Birnbaum, investigative journalist, academic, and the author of a new book on not-for-profit investigative journalism in the United States. You mentioned the ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalism, run by one of our former colleagues, Gerald Ryle.
Yes.
And you were there at the beginning, and of course, most recently, they've been known for the big data leaks, the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers, and of course, most recently, the implant files. Do you see that kind of large-scale, collaborative, trans-border, possibly data-led type journalism being replicable outside of the ICIJ, or is the kind of the ICIJ the sort of last word in that?
Well, there's the ICIJ, there's the OCCRP, I think they're called, which does similar work in Europe and parts of the Balkans and Eastern Europe. There are other European-based collaborative outfits involving mainstream media, mainstream public and non-profit media. So I guess what I'm saying is that I'm seeing this trend to collaboration continuing. So when I interviewed Bill Keller, who was the executive editor of the New York Times and now runs the Marshall Project, which is a non-profit that looks at the criminal justice system, and he says the biggest change he's seen in his lifetime is this move to collaborative arrangements. And so You know, ICIJ, at the heart of ICIJ is one word, and that's trust.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I can be a journalist investigating something in Australia, given a database provided by the ICIJ, Gerard Ryle. Colleagues around the world in different countries are working, and we've given this undertaking that we're not going to scoop each other.
Mm.
That's a totally new thing in journalism, really.
Yeah,
that,
of course.
You know, that we are seeing that the combined efforts, the whole is bigger than the individual parts. So, I'm currently involved in the network committee of the ICIJ, and what we do is approve new members and reject some applications. And the one thing we actually look at several things when we're looking at journalists. We're looking at the country they're in, their media organisation, and the amount of collaboration and teamwork that they have done, because
right.
That's crucial, this kind of work. Do I see it spreading to other organisations? I'm not sure. I did try to set up a student equivalent to this back in my days at Monash, and I couldn't get funding for it. But, you know, the student press is very vigorous, as you know, in Australia, and I figured, well, what if all these student publications just did one story and did it in different states? So, you know, that's obviously a mini, small-scale version of it. But, yeah, collaboration is a big thing. But it's not really happening, apart from, say, Nick McKenzie and Four Corners and maybe one or two others, it's not happening in Australia. I think there's still this level of distrust, of suspicion, of maybe arrogance, that, you know, we're not going to give our story to television or to the publicly funded media. We're going to do it ourselves. And yet the reach and the impact of collaborative effort is far greater.
How would you, well, just on that, I mean, I think there might be an argument about scale, I suppose. You could talk about that. But also in terms of regional journalism, where, you know, these news deserts are emerging in this country in particular, I think, what could be done there? What needs to be done?
Well, that's a good question. If we had a system of tax deductibility for non-profit journalism in this country, we might see more professional journalists setting up organisations and collaborating with regional newspapers to report on areas of public interest. Now, that's still a fair way off, but I think DGR, tax deductibility, and I can talk a lot more about what that might look like, might be a step in terms of having, again, these collaborations between, I guess, mainly the ABC in those areas, some of the regional papers, and a non-profit, you know, all working on the same story. But that is an area of enormous need, I agree, in Australia.
Yeah, because it's not happening at all. Not at all. Yeah, okay.
No.
Are you, I always like to finish on an optimistic note. Are you optimistic about the future of journalism?
Yes, I am.
Why?
Unlike some of my colleagues. because I think of the teaching experience. You know, the university showed me that a lot of the young journalists coming through today, you know, the old journos and the old sub-editors, a lot of them would kind of dismiss them as sort of millennials, you know, who only are interested in shallow things and no substance at all. I think young people are interested in politics, are interested in the media, no more than we give them credit for. Mm. I think that this move to setting up startups is starting to occur. Maybe it's a bit behind what's happening in the US, well, way behind, and some other countries. But I think there's a clamouring for quality information. And as I see it, people are sick and tired of journalism that they don't value, that is of no value to them. And so I think they're willing to put their hands in their pocket and pay for information. They're willing to subscribe to digital media. I'm talking about the mainstream media, maybe not some of the natives. And I think there's an increasing willingness to regard what's free on the internet largely as rubbish, you know, listicles and icicles and lists of this and lists of that, or Facebook for that matter. One information that's been verified by someone that's impartial, that's non-partisan, and that is going to help them make key decisions in their lives.
As a beautiful note to finish on, Bill Birnbaugh, thank you so much for being on Fourth Estate. I'm going to read out the full title of the book. It's The Rise of Nonprofit Investigative Journalism in the United States. It's by our guest today, Bill Birnbaugh. And Bill, thank you so much for your time. And I hope to see you in full, not just your behind, in the near future.
Great to talk to you, Peter.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
And I do say go buy the book or borrow it from your library. It ain't cheap, but it's worth it. That's it from the Fourth Estate for this edition. Make sure you subscribe to the Fourth Estate on your favorite podcast app so you can hear us talk media, politics, and a few things in between at your leisure. We'll be back with more next week. But in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is Fourth Estate AU. My name is Peter Frey. The producer is Anthony Dockrell. Thank you so much for listening.